Hey guys, I've asked Dan to teach today. Dan has done a great job with his discipleship lessons and the apostles, and he's been a real help for me, big relief. So, Dan, thank you for coming up here and being willing to do that. And
thank you for the opportunity.
All right, brother. Thank you, man. Appreciate you, dude.
And thank all of you for coming to the amateur preaching series. I had a very good history teacher in the ninth grade that made it a subject I did not care for, something I was passionate for. For one reason, she brought it to life. She put skin on these people. This series, I have endeavored to do the same thing. I was blessed with reading a book called 12 Ordinary Men by John MacArthur, and he changed the way I read the Gospels especially. It makes a difference when you feel like you know the setting of the play, if you will. Before I start with the remaining eight, we have covered the first four. Most of you have been here for that. I'll try to at least graze over the four most crucial apostles. But before I do, I'd like to set a little bit of the political background of what's been going on in the years leading up to the Messiah's return. after the children of Israel came back from Babylon, they rebuilt the temple. And what ensued was a series of dynasties of different kings. And they were, for the most part, pretty autonomous. They made their own rules. But the last one of that ilk was the Hasmonean dynasty. The last queen of the Hasmonean dynasty, and I'm going to throw some names at you, but don't worry so much about the names. It's the background that I want to get at. Alexandra Salome was the last queen of that dynasty. When she died, she left two sons, Hyrcanus and Aristobulus. I'm going to call them Brother One and Brother Two because it's really not important what their names were. This started a war, a civil war that was going on, about the same time that Pompey, who was a general and governor in the Roman Empire, had just settled the Syrian province. So he was asked to come in and settle this dispute and settle down this area. Through some back and forth, he ended up backing Brother Number One. Well, Brother Number One's took over, and he backed Caesar during the civil war that was going on in Rome at the time. And during this time is when Caesar was murdered, and it was split into three, and Mark Antony ended up with the easternmost area of the Roman Empire. Well, there was a man that Hyrcanus had put in charge of basically everything. His name, he was the chief minister. His name was Antipater the Idumean. In other words, he was from Edom. he's not so important, but he had two sons. One was Phasael, and one was Herod. This is where Herod comes from. Well, Herod and Phasael take over basically the military arm of it. And then brother number two's son, Artagonius, goes to the Parthian army and has them come in and try to do a takeover. So in 37 BC, actually 38 BC, Herod escapes to Masada and ends up going to Petra, and eventually winds up in Rome, where he asks Mark Anthony for help. Well, Mark Anthony sent his troops in, and in 37 BC, the Herodian dynasty started. But much like North Korea of today, it was a puppet dictatorship. He ruled by the will of the Roman Empire. And in 37 BC is when the Roman glove was firmly on the neck of Israel. Now, to give a little background of the sects of the Jewish faith, the Pharisees were the conservatives of the day. They were very strict and rigid, much too strict and rigid, as it turns out, by Jesus' own words. They strained out the gnat and swallowed the camel. We're going to worry about how much you tithe of mint and cumin and all that. Don't worry about what's happening at the temple on Saturday nights. So they actually came to be in 515 BC when the second temple was built. The second group is the Hellenists. The Hellenists came along in 333 BC when Alexander the Great took over the world, and it's basically a merger of Greek and Jewish philosophy, the Hellenists. They still existed in Jesus' day, but much of it had morphed into the third group, the Sadducees. The Sadducees were the liberal group. There's really not an afterlife. This is really not to be taken too seriously. It's just kind of guidelines for life. Blah, 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 blah. They had a lot of conflicts with the Pharisees and the true conservative. About the same time, the Essenes came onto the scene. The Essenes were a very separatist. They were a strong fundamentalist group that actually separated themselves from everyday life in Jerusalem, went out into the wilderness, and that's actually where John the Baptist started. I mean, he was in that group. He was cut from the same cloth, I should say. And in 37 BC, when Herod took over, you had a new group, the Herodians, which were basically Hellenistic, but they believed that Herod was the true king of Israel and was basically a legitimate successor to the throne of David. So you have all five of these groups. Well, a different group comes around in 6 AD when Judas the Galilean takes these people who have experienced the Roman boot on their neck too long and establishes the Zealots. They ended up with an uprising that was quickly crushed by the Romans, and Judas was murdered and his sons were crucified. But the Zealots went underground. They no longer did their thing in public, but they did it in private. Now, the Zealots were dedicated to the overthrow of Rome. They did not accept They were the absolute opposite of the Hellenists. They did not accept Roman rule. They believed it was a sin to accept rule other than God over Israel. And they had a special group in there named the Sicarii. It means curved blade. They were terrorists. They would walk into a crowd in a crowded forum with their curved blade, stick it between the ribs of a Roman guard, Roman dignitary, whatever, tax collector, pierce his heart, turn around and walk away and let the chaos ensue. This group obviously will come to prominence later on, but and as a matter of fact, Judas the Galilean was mentioned in the book of Acts. If you remember, they were trying to determine what to do with John and Peter. And they'd flogged them and all this. And a man named Gamaliel, who actually, one of his most famous students was a young man named Saul, who later became Paul, who was a teacher of the law there, stood up and said, "Look, we've had pretenders before." Judas the Galilean was one of the things that he mentioned. And his followers fell away. If this is not of God, it'll fall away. If it is of God, you don't want to be standing in its way when it rolls through. Okay, so enough background information. The apostles are always listed in three groups of four for very good reason. If you look at it as concentric circles going out from Jesus, you can understand it better. The first four are always 1 Peter. Peter was the leader, not just in name, in everything. He was the leader. Then you have his brother Andrew, James, son of Alphaeus, and his brother John. Now, they were all fishermen. They were two sets of brothers. And they became the inner circle. Not so much Andrew, but he was integral, but he was not involved in everything that the other three were. They were everywhere Jesus was at all times. Now, the thing that I've gotten most out of studying these men is the point of the title of John MacArthur's book, 12 Ordinary Men. Jesus didn't come and seek priests, holy men, educated men, none of that. He picked men seemingly at random. Four brothers all in the same place at the same time. Y'all come with me. Basically on the same day, Philip, come on. Just all of them except for Judas Iscariot were from the Galilean region. None of them were educated. None of them had any pedigree that would lend them to the leadership of a church except availability and answering the call. Okay. The fifth disciple, the first in the second group of four, is always Philip. We only know the name Philip. He had a Jewish name for certain. He was Jewish. But we only know the name Philip, which is a Greek name, which tells historians that he was probably from a family of Hellenists. You'll find out that they came from all different backgrounds. Startlingly stark, different backgrounds. He was born in Bethsaida, just like Peter and Andrew were. Came from the same place. He was likely a fisherman as well, because when Christ had already come back and gone away, and during that 40 days, Peter says, forget it, I'm going fishing. He's one of the group that said, going with you. So we can infer that he was one of the fishermen of the group. There may have been as many as seven that were fishermen. We don't know all the jobs that these men filled. He was among the first to be called by Jesus. Does everyone have a Bible? Does anyone need a Bible?
I would love a Bible.
Do what now?
Nothing. I have a favorite.
Oh. I think that's it.
You knew it. Thank you.
I've studied by that one before. I love it.
Yes.
That is our illustrious leader's blood, sweat, and tears on those pages. Okay. John 1:34. If I could get somebody to read that.
John 1:34?
Yes.
I have seen and I testify that this is God's chosen one.
Sorry, that may be John, 1 John.
Yeah,
that's where
I got this John 1 gospel. You know, 1 John?
John 1, 30, 43. Excuse me.
Oh, 1 John, okay.
No.
It says John 1, 43.
John
1,
43.
Okay.
Oh, I
did
34 too.
Okay.
I did too.
The day following, Jesus would go forth into Galilee and find a Philip and say unto him,
okay, so the day after he had met Andrew and John by the side of John the Baptist's ministry, he meets Philip. That tells historians, he was more than likely also one among those with John the Baptist. The following verses will also tell us that directly after that, they went to the wedding of Cana, in Cana, where Jesus turned the water into wine. He was more than likely among those disciples. John simply says he and his disciples went to Cana. Okay. I'm going to touch on the different times when it shows him in the Bible, and we'll see what it says about him. John 6:5. Can I get somebody to read that? I'll read some of it.
When Jesus looked up and saw a great crowd coming toward him, he said to Philip, "Where shall we buy bread for these people to eat?"
Okay. So during the feeding of the 5,000, Jesus addresses him specifically. Now that and others tells us that he was more than likely in charge of logistics. He was the guy Jesus talked to and said, "Go get us a room to take the Passover in." He was the guy when they needed something done. Judas Iscariot held the money purse, but he was the guy that was sent to take care of the issues. John 12:21, I'll read that. It says, actually starting in 20, "Now some Greeks were among those who went up to worship at the festival. So they came to Philip, who was from Bethsaida in Galilee, and requested of him, 'Sir, we want to see Jesus.' Jesus went and told Andrew. Then Andrew and Philip went and told Jesus. Jesus replied to them, 'The hour has come for the Son of Man to be glorified.'" Philip was more than likely the guy in the corporate office that always has at least an unofficial and possibly an official guidebook to everything. And refers to it no matter what. He was the bean counter. He was the guy. It's a process. We've got to do it this way. Well, he didn't know whether Jesus wanted to meet the Greeks. So he goes to the one guy that will take anybody to Jesus. Andrew. And says, hey, let's take. He wasn't so sure Jesus would want it done that way. But he knew he could pass it off to Andrew. And if something happened to Andrew, get blamed. Okay, and the last one is John 14:8. This is in the upper room as Jesus is preparing them that he is leaving.
Okay. Philip said, Lord, show us the Father and that will be enough for us.
After everything that he had been through in the last 3 years, he utters what may be among the most cringeworthy words in the New Testament that basically break the Lord's heart, because his response is, have I been with you so long and you don't know who I am? He always needed a little more proof and a little more prodding. That's basically all we know about Philip. And you'll notice as we go through this, almost exclusively, all of these eight final, more peripheral apostles, other than being mentioned in the list of apostles in all three synoptic gospels and in Acts, except for Judas Iscariot, who was already dead, they're only mentioned in John. John had a different writing style. He was more relational. He probably knew these guys a little better. And they weren't really necessarily the center point of what the other Gospels were about. It was, you know, laser focused on Jesus, and everybody else is listed as one of the apostles. But John gives names and all that. After biblical record, earliest church records say that he was a missionary to Greece, Syria, Phrygia.
Okay. So we got Greece up in here. Yeah. We got Syria, Phrygia, it's up in here,
and what? And in Hierapolis, which is in modern day Turkey now, in Phrygia, he was martyred. Like all of the apostles other than John, who they tried to kill and couldn't, he was martyred for his faith. Early church teaching says that he had converted the wife of the proconsul of Hierapolis. He was either beheaded or crucified. We're not particularly sure. His tomb was actually found in 2011 in Turkey. Okay, so on to Nathanael. Now, I skipped over when Philip was first called to the Lord. His first act, just like Andrew's first act was to run to Peter and tell him we found the Messiah. Well, Philip's first act was to run to Nathanael. Nathanael was more than likely a very, very close friend, brother, cousin, whatever, to Philip, because he's the first person that Philip thought of. He was born in Cana. His other name that's listed in the list, he's also called Bartholomew. Bartholomew is a surname. It means son of Ptolemy. If Jesus were called in their vernacular, he would have been Jesus Bar Joseph. Bar means son of. Okay, so in the same passage, let's open up to John 1:43 again, because we're going to learn a whole lot more about Nathanael from this passage than we ever did about Philip. In 45, it says, Philip found Nathanael and told him, "We have found the one Moses wrote about in the law and also the prophets, Jesus, the son of Joseph from Nazareth." Now, what can we learn from just that? Philip and Nathanael.
I'm sorry, you're asking this question.
Oh, no, go ahead.
They followed the laws in the prophecies of the Jewish faith.
Exactly. Philip and Nathanael had studied waiting for the Messiah. They knew the references. They were actively seeking, where is he? He's coming any time now. Daniel told us when. Which is obviously why when John the Baptist shows up, they go running out to the Jordan. They were not going to be left behind in this information.
But when Philip found him and he talks to Nathanael, Nathanael says, "Can anything good come from there?"
Right. Now remember, Nathanael was from Cana. Cana's not far from Nazareth. And we think of Nazareth now because Jesus was from Nazareth. Nazareth is some quaint little town, whatever. Nazareth was a crossroads. If you were bringing things into the Galilean region from the sea, you went through Nazareth. So that means it was populated with tax collectors. That means it was a rough and tumble type of place. There was a lot of rough characters. It was not necessarily a real safe place to be when the sun went down.
We call that the hood.
Exactly. And it really was. For him to say that, it's a little bit prejudicial. But what he's saying is, okay, I've been through Nazareth. Surely the Messiah is not coming out of there. But yeah, you took me straight to my next point there, Roy, and I appreciate that. And Philip's answer is simple. It's exactly what we're to come and see. Come find out exactly who he is. He'll convince you. I don't need to try to convince you of anything. So then we get to his meeting with Jesus. And he gets the honor of being the man introduced more agreeably than anybody in history. Then Jesus saw Nathanael coming toward him and said about him, "Here is a true Israelite, no deceit is in him." Now, at the end of my life, I hope Jesus gives me some kind of condemnation that's close to that. But to walk up on the Son of God, and that's how he greets you, that tells you a lot about who Nathanael truly was. Now, Nathanael, it's interesting because Nathanael, his first, how do you know me? I've never met you before. How do you know me? And Jesus says, "Before Philip called you, when you were under the fig tree, I saw you." Before we get to Nathanael's response, let me explain something. In that area, they didn't have houses like we have now. They were small. They were cramped. There was usually a fire burning all day long for cooking. So you didn't stay in the house and lounge around. It was outside. So that what they would do is they would plant trees around, make shady areas so that you could lounge outside and all this. He was under a fig tree, which is tops out at 15 feet. It's got a short, gnarly trunk. So we're talking about a low, shady area. This is where the man laid and studied Scripture. So when Jesus says, "I saw you there," it's as if he's saying, when you were speaking to God, I was there. Immediately, that fast, Nathanael gets it. Gets what Philip didn't get at the Last Supper. He says, "Rabbi, you are the Son of God. You are the King of Israel." Jesus, "You believe only because I told you that I saw you under the fig tree. You will see greater things than this. Behold, I will show you. I assure you, you will see heaven open and the angels of God ascending and descending on the Son of Man." That points back to something else Nathanael would have known very well. When Jacob had camped in that very area of Jerusalem and slept with his head on a pillow, he dreamed of a ladder coming out of heaven and angels going up and down out of heaven. That God was going to make a connection between heaven and earth. That is Jesus. It was a foreshadowing of Jesus. Now, we don't know a whole lot more about Nathanael than that. Extra-biblical early accounts say that he was a missionary to Ethiopia, Mesopotamia, Parthia, Laconia, and Armenia. He was martyred in Albanopolis, Armenia, for converting the king of Armenia. The execution was ordered by the king's brother. He was either likely beheaded or flayed alive and crucified. Third in this list is Matthew, also known as Levi, son of Alphaeus. Now, Matthew is best known because he was a tax collector. Tax collectors were the most hated vermin in Jewish society. They'd rather hang out with a prostitute, they'd rather hang out with a leper than a tax collector, because tax collectors were in collusion with the Romans and stealing their money. They had a certain amount they had to collect for Rome, but anything they collected over that was theirs. They were given the authority, and they absolutely used it. He was born in Galilee. One of the important things about his profession is because he was a tax collector at a crossroads, he was at a booth when he was called, he was a master of tachygraphy. Tachygraphy was a basic shorthand that allowed them to, you would have one tax collector, the head of the tax collectors, counting off the stuff on the cart, and the guy behind him with a notepad writing it down as fast as he can count it, so that they can figure up the tax. Why is that important? Because Matthew's gospel is the single richest in terms of Jesus' actual words. You look at the Sermon on the Mount alone. Three complete chapters of a speech that Jesus gave, because Matthew was able to take shorthand and sit and actually write the words that were coming from Jesus. Not later on, Here's the gist of what Matthew was recording his words. He also was very well versed in Scripture. His gospel, and we know most of what we know about Matthew because not of him writing about himself, he almost never referred to himself, but because of what he wrote, because of the style that he wrote, who he was writing to, we know a lot about who he is. And he quotes the Old Testament, not just the law, the prophets, the history. He quotes all spectrums of the Old Testament throughout his gospel. He knew the Scriptures. Well, here's this outcast of the Jews, not allowed in the temple. He's poring over Scriptures at night. This is a man tormented. I find a little joy in believing that the parable in Luke 8 that Jesus told, he doesn't actually say it's a parable. Some of his parables are clearly parables. This one he simply says, two men went up to the temple. One was a Pharisee, and he stood up and talked about how, thank you, God, that I'm not like other men. I tithe, I fast twice a week, I do this and I do that, and I'm not like that tax collector. And he said, and the other man, and I almost can see Jesus looking dead in Matthew's eyes. He may have been that public. The other man stood afar off, would not even lift his eyes, beat his breast, said, Lord, have mercy on me, a sinner. That man went away to his home, forgiven. That's, whether that was Matthew or not, that was him. That was his heart. He knew that he was a sinner, that he was lost to any redemption. His call is well known. Jesus simply walked past him at the tax booth and said, follow me. He drops everything and trust me, there was somebody right behind him to pick it up. His entire everything he walked away from. That very day he gave a banquet. He invited tax collectors, harlots, the people that would associate with him. He wanted to bring everybody that he knew into this man's presence. It's almost as if, this is all I have to offer you, Lord, but I give it to you. Now, he was always a missionary to the Jews. He wrote his gospel to the Jews. It was all about trying to convince the Jews that their Messiah had come. We don't know exactly where all he traveled, but in Judea and outside of Judea, he was always seeking Jewish communities. And somewhere, we don't know where, he was martyred. And it's believed that he was burned at the stake. The fourth in the second list is Thomas. Thomas was also called Didymus, which means twin. We don't know if he was a twin. Maybe he looked like Jesus. We don't have any idea why he was called the twin, but he was called the twin. Now, Thomas gets a bad rap. Everybody knows his nickname.
Doubting
Thomas. Thomas wasn't necessarily so much of a doubter as he was prone to negative thoughts. He's the Eeyore of the Bible.
You said something while ago that Philip kind of lent into that personality, right?
Well,
I don't mean to throw you off. I wonder if he was a twin.
He was just he worried about making sure everything was done right. He was kind of the nerdy guy in the office that's always telling you, we've got to do it this way. We can't do that. No, we got to stay inside the lines. Philip was more that way. Thomas was just easily dejected. I mean, you see, in every time that he comes to the forefront, you see that negativity come out. But he had qualities. He wasn't faint of heart. In John 11:16, it records Jesus has been chased out of the immediate area of Jerusalem. They tried to stone him. So he's off out ministering, and Mary and Martha send word that Lazarus is sick. Jesus says, it won't end in death, and stays there another 4 days. Another 2 days. When he finally decides to leave and go there, the apostles are saying, wait a minute. We know they're going to try to kill you. You said he wasn't going to die. He said, Lazarus sleeps. Well, if he's sleeping, he'll get better. I said, no, he's dead. And I'm glad that it happened this way so that you can learn some faith. Well, it was Thomas that turns to him and says, let's all go and die with him. It's his response. Yes, it's negative. It's downcast. It's mopey. But it's, I ain't living without him. In the same conversation where Philip makes us all cringe by telling Jesus to show us the Father, right before that, Jesus had said, you know where I'm going, and you know the way. Well, Thomas is the one who says, Lord, we don't know where you're going. We don't know how to get there. He's, again, just like that, he's deeply concerned that they're going to be left without Jesus. I mean, what are we without you, Lord? And then the famous doubting passage is, again, he was prone to dejection. He was the only apostle that did not take comfort in being together 2 days after Jesus died. He needed to be alone. So he walks out, goes and deals with his sorrow his own way. And when he comes back, you know, they tell him, Jesus just showed up. He was just here. Again, to someone who is prone to dejection, he waits till I leave. So he says, I will not believe it unless I see him. I want to see him. Unless I can stick my hand in the nail hole and put my hand in his side, I'm not going to believe it. 8 days later, Jesus shows up. Everyone's crowded around him, and he looks dead at Thomas. Put your finger in my hand. Put your hand in my side. Believe. Thomas hits his knees. He doesn't need any more.
If you've been with him that whole time, you'd think after a little bit of time, you've been with him long enough to see all the miracles he'd done.
But it was no one at that point, none of the apostles understood when he would tell them, I'm going to die and I'm going to come back. He would say it almost that plainly, and it just right over their head. Well, so he wasn't the only one. Peter, who should have known if no one else did, was so dejected even after he saw the Lord. It took the Lord making breakfast for him and restoring him in order to come back from this. I mean, they were all devastated. It wasn't just him. He actually became one of the most fervent in missionary work. He went as far as India. We know that he brought widespread Christianity to India. And he was martyred in Mylapore, which is modern-day Chennai. Interestingly enough, the apologist Ravi Zacharias grew up within walking distance of this tomb. And is definitely one of the direct recipients of his faithfulness. Oddly enough as well, by most accounts, and this was in 72 AD when he was martyred, and he was run through with a spear, which for a man who was truly convinced by being invited to put his hand in the spear wound, just kind of neat synergy. The last four, there's not so much known about them, so don't worry, I don't think I'll go over. The first name in all the Gospels in the last four is always James, son of Alphaeus. He's also known as James the Less. More than likely because there was already another James, a very big James, who was right there at Christ's elbow. It also may point to the fact that he may have been younger, even smaller, than the rest of the apostles. We know as much about him from his mother as anything. His mother and apparently father as well were intricately involved in ministering to Jesus' ministry. She was one of the women that was there to make sure he had everything that was cooking, taking care of the mundane household things that go along with a big ministry. Okay, and she was definitely there till the very end. She is listed in several Gospels as being at the foot of the cross during the crucifixion. Now this also adds a little bit of confusion because, number one, he's known as James, son of Alphaeus. Well, Levi's dad's name was Alphaeus as well. It's possible they were brothers, I doubt it. Also, in one of the Gospels, John, actually, John refers to the Lord's sister, Mary, or Lord's mother's sister, Mary, wife of Cleopas, and Mary Magdalene. So there's three Marys there, obviously. Wife of Cleopas, okay. Maybe she was remarried. Maybe it was another name for Alphaeus, or whatever. But if this is the same mother of James, then that would make James Jesus' cousin. We don't know for certain, but it certainly lends to conjecture. Also, Mark refers to her as one of the women who went to prepare his body on Sunday morning. So we know it was a family passion following Jesus. It wasn't just James. We know that he was a missionary to Syria, Persia, possibly Egypt. He was martyred by either being stoned, beaten, or crucified. Second in the list is Judas, always referred to as not Iscariot. Unfortunately, Judas is a fine name. It was a very popular name in the day. It has been forever ruined by one man. And every one of the apostles, every one of the writers of the New Testament made sure to clarify every time they spoke of this man, not Iscariot. He also had two other names that give us a little bit of information as to who he was. Thaddeus, or Thaddeus Labius. Thaddeus is roughly translated breast child. Mama's boy. Almost derisive. It may refer to him being the youngest and smallest of his family. Maybe it was a name that followed him throughout. Maybe it had a little bit to do with the image that he portrayed. Labius means heart child. So you kind of get a picture of who this guy, a little cherub, you know, just a sweet guy, always, you know. This is all revealed just by his three names. Now, apart from the list, he only appears in the Gospels one time. And that is in John 14. Let's start 21 probably. Make sure of where to stop. Okay, let's go 21 to 22. Can somebody read that for me?
14:21?
Yes.
They preached the good news in that city and won a large number of disciples. Then they returned to Lystra, Iconium, and Antioch. Keep going.
Yes?
I'm sorry.
John
14.
Boom, I'm an axe.
Oh. Okay.
That's my fault.
John 14:21.
Yes. 21 and 22.
Can you get it?
Sure.
Whoever has my commands and keeps them is the one who loves me. The one who loves me will be loved by my Father, and I too will love them and show myself to them. Then Judas, not Judas Iscariot, said, "But Lord, why do you intend to show yourself to us and not to the world?"
Okay. So you see that our image of him is pretty dead on. Of all the things that he's quoted in the Bible about, it's him looking at Jesus and saying, "Why is this just for us? Why aren't you saying this to the whole world? Don't they deserve to know salvation?" He had a really big heart. It's the only place that he shows up. He was a missionary to Judea, Samaria, Idumea, or Edom, Syria, Mesopotamia, and Libya. In Edessa, Mesopotamia, he was martyred, and more than likely, he was beat to death with a club. In all historic Catholic art, he is portrayed with a club. Now we get to probably one of the most interesting characters, Simon the Zealot. Hence the reason for making y'all understand exactly who a zealot was back then. Now, let's first stop and realize what kind of a leader can put Simon and Matthew in the same room. I mean, a year before, and Matthew would have been looking over his shoulder, and Simon would have been looking for his knife. I mean, this is not conventionally a good combination, but he made it work.
Do you all understand who the Zealots were? They were terrorists. They were Israeli terrorists. They were trying to overthrow Rome.
Is it the sword guy you were talking about earlier?
Yeah, oh, Sicarii. Yeah. Not all Zealots were Sicarii. They were specially chosen. But the Zealots were, that's what they were all about. It was sedition. It was, let's take them down from the inside. A lot of guerrilla warfare and things. Now, the fact that he is still, years after, when the Gospels are being written, referred to as Simon the Zealot, tells you that it wasn't just his affiliation, it was also his temperament. He was a passionate, very brave, very determined man. You get the idea that other than Peter, there was probably no one less prone to half measures than Simon the Zealot. We're going for it, and we're going all the way. He would have been the most likely, if you would have polled everyone, all the disciples, not just the apostles, around him, if you had polled who's most likely to betray Jesus, it probably would have been Simon the Zealot, because it became very plain toward the end of his ministry, we're not taking over and casting out Rome. This isn't what I'm about. I'm here to save you from your sin, not from your oppressors. It appears that that's one of the major reasons that Judas Iscariot became disenchanted, is because he expected this rulership. He thought he was going to be on the ground floor of it. He's keeping the man's money pouch. When he comes to power, I'm right there.
Well, he was going to get a kingship at some point.
Exactly. He was lining his pockets already, but he was looking for a big payday coming down the road. We'll get to Judas Iscariot. We know a whole lot about him. But he was very faithful till the very end. He took the gospel north. He may have been killed with Judas Thaddeus Labius. They were very intimately connected with each other in early church history. And it is entirely possible that he was clubbed to death along with him. Now, we get to the son of perdition. Judas Iscariot, son of Simon, was... His last name is not so much a surname as it is a descriptive name. Is means man of. Iscariot, man of Cariot. More than likely, Cariot Hezron, which is in southern Judea. He was the only one not from Galilee. He was the only one that was not, more than likely, already familiar with each other. And it's also important to understand that this is one of the biggest places where we have this conflict between being preordained and free will. Jesus knew from the moment he looked into this man's eyes, he's going to be the one. He's going to steal the money out of the coffers, and he's going to sell me for the price in Leviticus that was given that you must restore for the death of a slave.
But if you knew from the beginning, why have him holding the money first the whole time?
It was meant to happen, right? Jesus allowed it to happen.
He was allowing him, it's almost like a bait car situation. He was giving him the opportunity to do right or wrong. It is your choice.
Free will.
I know what you're going to do.
But I'm giving you free will to decide.
But it's all up to you. I'm giving you trust. I'm putting you in a place of high responsibility I'm giving you no reason to be offended at me at all. The only time that he is ever called out in Scripture is when Mary bathes the Lord's feet with her tears, wipes his feet with her hair, and anoints them with a perfume that was worth a year's wages. I mean, and John even says, Simon objected and said, why was this not sold for 300 denarii and given to the poor? And Jesus reprimands him and says, poor you always have with you. She understands I'm not going to be. But John makes it clear. He said that not because he cared anything about the poor, but because he held the money purse and saw it as a big payday. Judas. I'm sorry. Now, it's interesting to point out that any time that Jesus talked about I'm going to be betrayed, this and that, even at the Last Supper when everybody's going, is it me, Lord? Is it me? No one ever picked out Judas. He was a skilled liar. He was a very good manipulator. And no one at all had any suspicion of him. Even when Jesus told him, go and do what you've got to do. Right after saying that, half the apostles think, oh, well, he's telling him to go give money to the poor. So John was the only one that knew because John was over here whispering to Jesus. Who is it? Now, after he has sold out the Lord and the Lord's been arrested, he suddenly gets hit by his conscience, something in the arrest. Maybe Jesus looking at him and saying, you're betraying me with a kiss. He immediately repents of his actions, goes and into the temple and says, I've betrayed innocent blood. Take this money back. You see to it. Too late, no backsies. Well, he throws the silver down in the temple and goes and hangs himself. It's interesting to note that although he was struck with a guilty conscience, he never repented. He did not fall to his knees and beg for forgiveness. If he had, he'd be in heaven today. Jesus made it very clear. He's not.
Really?
Now,
I never knew that. Where is that at?
He says on a few occasions, the one that sticks out to me most is, he says, it is foretold that the Son of Man should be betrayed, but woe to the man who does that. It would have been better if he had never been born.
Okay.
Now, there seems to be a discrepancy because the Gospels say that he hung himself, and then in Acts it says that he fell and burst his intestines out. Okay, well, how does that work? Well, he hangs himself from a limb off of a high cliff or off of a rocky cliff. Jewish law forbids you to touch a dead body, especially on the Sabbath, which would have been the same day Jesus was crucified. He's hanging. So the body bloats, rots in the sun. Either the limb breaks, the rope breaks, he breaks, whatever, hits the ground, flat. Both are correct. this is... hopefully, if nothing else that you've gained from this, it makes you a little more interested and brings it a little more to life to read the Gospels. When you understand who these men are, how Jesus, by interacting with these men, Jesus shows us how he responds to us. We are all these men in one facet or another. And it's rock hard, solid proof that he does not call the prepared, he prepares those who are called. Thank you very much for your attention.